Good afternoon. This is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Bill 10.1, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. Ellen, can you please take the roll for attendance? Ellen, are you there? It looks like we might be experiencing some technical difficulties. Laura, would you be able to take the roll for attendance?
Yep, here. Sorry, yes. Chair Richardson.
Present.
Vice Chair Hassan.
Present.
Lead Erickson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Foe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Jordan. Did I? Okay. And Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Scott? Representative Scott? Representative Erdahl?
Present.
And Representative Waslowick?
Present.
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Madam Chair, my name wasn't called in roll call. I just want to make sure that I'm marked as present. Thank you.
My apologies. I will mark you as present.
Thank you, Representative Keeler, and thank you, Laura, for jumping in to take the role for us. The next order of business is the approval of the January 27th minutes. Representative Edelson, have you had a moment to review the minutes?
So moved, Chair.
All in favor of approving the January 27th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Today's hearing is going to be focused on the Select Committee on Racial Justice report and recommendations related to education. As many of you are aware, Minnesota is home to some of the most significant disparities facing Black, Indigenous, and students of color within the nation, not only as it relates to school discipline disparities, but as it relates to the opportunity gap and graduation rates as well. We have seen that these disparities are persistent, and not only are they persistent, they are very unacceptable as well. And as we have been focused quite a bit on race, on racial equity within the first several hearings of this committee, we also recognize, as has been stated by some previous testifiers, that it can be very challenging and difficult to talk about the disparities that we're seeing and also the issues related to systemic racism. But we just want to really acknowledge that the difficulty in having these conversations is an indication that something is deeply wrong within our educational system, because if these were not if these were easy conversations and easy problems, these would be easy conversations to have. So just want to recognize that the work that we have to do is very complex. It's very difficult, but we have a number of recommendations that came from the House Select Committee on Racial Justice related to education. And this will be an opportunity for community to weigh in on the recommendations that came up as a result of that work. We have a full agenda ahead of us today, and I want to start off with Dr. Bruce Corey, who was a key testifier within the House Select Committee on Racial Justice, and I believe that you're going to be sharing your screen, so I want to allow you to move to do that, and also if you'd want to introduce yourself to the committee before beginning. We're very grateful for you taking the time out of what I know is a very busy schedule for you to talk a little bit about education and the Minnesota solution. Thank you, Dr. Corey. Welcome.
Sorry, I was unmuted, Chair. Thank you, Chair Richardson. It's my honor to be here to present some information to you and the committee. I want to, at the beginning, acknowledge my appreciation for the report of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice. We find that a number of people agree that systemic racism exists in Minnesota and it has its impact. And what this report does, it helps to clarify and identify processes and ways in which racism has its impacts on people and the lives of people and the economy of Minnesota. And today, I'm going to be presenting you some data and analysis based from an economic point of view on the economic cost of racism. By way of introduction, I'm a economist at Concordia University, and my particular education focus has been right from my college days to now a professor of economics, as well as I've served as an accreditor with a national accreditation body, and they sent me to Mongolia and India and other parts of the U.S. To assess programs in terms of standards. And so I bring some of this experience and insights into this conversation, and my presentation today will focus on the role of representation, of political representation of economic interests, some facts on the economic costs of racism, and then focus on the educational disparities as identified in the report and provide some analysis on the recommendation. If we were to look at all the legislative districts in Minnesota, there are at least 125 legislative districts that have at least $100 million of BIPOC Alana economic interests. That means a very simple measure of income and as an indicator of a much larger economic presence in each of these legislative districts. And so 85% of Senate districts and 51% of House districts have this significant economic interest in their districts. And it is a constitutional, legal, moral, ethical obligation for interest, because we provided testimony to the judicial panel of redistricting, and our input has been integrated into the districts that have created these opportunities for representation. As you know, the Minnesota paradox of the worst racial disparities coexisting with a very vibrant economy, and what do we do about it? We also know, and it's well documented, of how we see racism historical footprint in these redlining districts across the state, where people's economic assets and livelihood were severely deprived. The root causes and impacts are even felt today. In the area of education, we find the channels of discrimination, filtering through the poor quality of education in schools or the lack of cultural intelligence in the classroom that ultimately results in the lack of college preparedness, students being pushed into remedial courses, paying college level prices, getting into the cycle of debt, and then into pushed into degrees that are not going to provide a living wage, one of the areas that are more protected in the economy, as we are seeing in the COVID crisis, and then the poor support systems in these educational institutions ultimately have that negative impact on our youth. Research in 1987, I showed how right from the mother's womb and the resources available to the mother and family, economic assets, resources, housing, sanitation, social systems all combine to have results in these negative outcomes. And so if you see a kid in the class who needs glasses, it's not just that particular experience in itself, but what are these historical patterns and the proper nutrition and healthcare and access that that kid needed to have in order to be successful. The issue of diversity, or the opportunity, I would say, the opportunity of diversity is not just in the metro area, but this data from niche.com talking about the most diverse school districts, you find all across Minnesota, we have this great talent of young people ready to build the new Minnesota. And the implication of these young people is they become today's workforce. And as again, when you look across Minnesota, from Northeast Minnesota, Central Minnesota, Northwest Minnesota, Southeast Minnesota, Southwest Minnesota and the Twin Cities, an integral connection between the workforce in some areas and some counties is pretty high, and the survival and the economic competitiveness of those areas. And over time, we find a number of reports that have been come up, including the one I helped author as chair of the Governor's Working Group on Minority Business Development in 2000. All these reports are lying on the shelf, waiting to be implemented in an integrative and coordinated way. And in the area of education, you can go back and see from 2001 that I found on Minip's website, documenting the story of our BIPOC children in the classroom. And all of this ultimately has its impact on the racial income gap. Blacks earn 71 cents on the dollar compared to whites, on the racial education gap. There's a 21% gap in the 6-year graduation rates between blacks and whites, the racial housing gap and the racial investment gap. And so when I combine all these different estimates, there's about a cost of about $287 billion that is borne both by the BIPOC communities themselves, but it's also a loss to the economy of Minnesota because it would have grown much higher if that potential were less, and the resulting impact on the tax revenue that you would get from a smaller base. And so I go in to estimate how this $287 billion is broken down between loss in income, loss in earnings, loss in business revenue, loss in home ownership, and that's how the toll adds up. So the question arises is, what can be done to leverage this BIPOC assets to build the Minnesotan economy? And Representative Ruth Richardson says it well, this is about advancing and promoting equal opportunity across all of our systems in the area of education, health, housing, public safety, economic, and workforce development. I also appreciate what I've heard Speaker Hortman and Chair Moran say, that the focus on inclusion is like butter in the batter. And as a kid, I helped my mom and I helped my aunts bake these cakes during Christmas time. And I know the role of butter in that batter and how it helps makes a great cake. But the important part is that as you put the butter in the batter, the cake can be enjoyed, the beautiful cake that comes out can be enjoyed by everybody. And so how do we start moving forward? I propose that the first thing is to change perceptions from a deficit approach to an asset approach, to understand that these BIPOC communities represent $1.4 trillion economy. That's huge. That's bigger than the economy of Mexico, for example. And it's very important to focus that way, because denying someone's value is one of the building blocks of systemic racism. If you deny somebody's worth, it's easier to exploit them. But if you acknowledge and respect it, you will unleash very powerful energies to build up Minnesota. And this $1.4 trillion, again, is broken down between income and businesses and lifetime earnings, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, and taxes and globals and cultural assets. So let's focus on the education place. And I encourage Chair Richardson and the committee to look at the youth in our schools and university system as a $1.5 trillion asset. How do I get $1.5 trillion? I took all the, about 500,000 young people in our system, and what would their lifetime earnings be if they all got a bachelor's degree? And so you see this young kid in the slide. That young kid can have a bachelor's degree or higher and get income about $3.6 million, or that kid could be a high school dropout and get income only about $900,000. So the power is in this legislative body, in this village of Minnesota, to make sure that every kid achieves that potential. And if that happens, Minnesota is going to get the benefit at the minimum of at least $1.5 trillion over the next years. And again, $1.5 trillion is bigger than the GDP of Mexico. So you have in your hand and in your power the opportunity to build up the assets bigger than the GDP of a country, a neighboring country of Mexico. And the cost of not doing that is reflected in the lifetime earnings of current BIPOC workforce that don't have the same level of education as the rest of Minnesota. And if I add it all up, they are experiencing an economic loss of $174 billion. And that means a lot. It means a lot at the low end of the scale when people trying to survive, not having that extra money to pay for housing, food, healthcare, and transportation, and preventing their own kids from getting a head start in the future. And so what when you look at the recommendations of the Select Committee on Racial Justice, they could be categorized into these four broad categories. And incidentally, a number of reports right from what's on the MDE's website, as well as Mineep and others that have come before you to talk about solutions, they can fall in these categories. The first, very important, is it's important for the kid entering the classroom or the youth entering the college that the environment is welcome and inclusive. They not only have to learn, but the social relationships that they achieve between the student and the teacher, between the student and their own peers, can have permanent positive or negative impacts on them. And we know it for a fact that our BIPOC kids are facing huge mental and emotional trauma because of some of these negative experiences that they have. So if you want to talk about systemic racism, how it continues in the system, we have to look at the inclusive and welcoming environment in our learning environments. The second bucket is that we need to have world-class education. Even though we might be talking about the achievement gap, the bar is very low in Minnesota. We are not globally competitive compared to a kid coming out of Singapore or places like that. And so we have to raise the bar considerably with considerable investment to raise the quality of education for everyone, and with a special focus on the ones left out. And then we need to have cultural intelligence and representation in the teachers and the staff and the curriculum that are, and I know it for a fact, being a professor, what difference can it make by having someone in the class who might know or who might be able to get an additional insight or to share about the economy, the ethnic economy in Minnesota. But this is important because it's tied to how someone receives knowledge, how someone's grow, how someone's potential is realized. And finally, we have to focus on the outcomes. And I hope every time you hear someone come with a bill, you focus on the questions of how well are the academic and career outcomes occurring, and what are lessons can be learned that we can build on it, because ultimately this has to result in those kids, those youth all getting into at least a bachelor's degree through their movement through the system. And finally, I will end by saying that when we focus on the young people and invest in these young people and they improve, they in turn will pull the rest of the economy up with them. As an African-American proverb says, lift as we climb. While we invest in our youth, we will climb. And I would say, never underestimate the potential of these young people. I would remember in my classes, around mid-semester, I'd be looking at the grades and I would find that there was these people in my class that are D's and F's. So I'd throw them a lifeline and say, hey, listen, my final is comprehensive. You really would have to think and write a very good answer for it. But if you give me an A, I'll think about your grade. And I would be amazed of the masterpieces I would get by these D's and F students as they write such insightful answers. So there is unlimited potential in our youth. Limits interest exists only in our mind. And if there's one thing I would ask you, is to always, always, always keep the youth and the child as the center of all that we are doing, not be swayed by interest groups, not be swayed by adults with our own interests, but what would work for the young child to make sure that they have the best opportunity to succeed. So thank you very much, Chair Richardson and members of the committee, for this opportunity to share some insights.
Thank you, Dr. Corey, for presenting your information. And we'll, as has been the practice, be holding questions until the very end, but we appreciate you being here. Next up, I have the privilege and honor of introducing retired Supreme Court Justice Alan Page. And just a little backstory, I met Justice Page when I was an elementary school student. His commitment to education is not something new. It's something that he has been doing for several decades within Minnesota. And last year, I had the chance to redeem myself with Justice Page. When he had visited my elementary school, I heckled him from the front row for not winning the Super Bowl that he played in, and he was gracious enough to forgive me for my heckling as a child. So, Justice Page, we are honored to have you here today, and the floor is yours.
Chair Richardson, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. I laugh only because that heckling from the crowd is that spirit and energy of children that for far too long we have been, for lack of a better word, beating out of them through an education system that, quite frankly, has failed them. It has failed them systematically and systemically. And as you know from the committee's report, when you stop and look at the stark numbers, it is frightening what we are doing to a whole class of children, who are creative, who are curious, and who have the ability to perform. But yet we say, time and time again, in order for these children to perform, we have to fix their families, we have to fix their surroundings, we have to fix any number of things. The fact is that if we give these children educational opportunity, we can create change. Now, I come to this, as you noted, with a long history. It started for me seeing the conflict between athletics and academics and figuring out that what I was seeing was an academic problem, not an athletic problem. It continued through my time on the court, reading transcripts of young people's testimony at hearings or trials where they had been accused of some crime. And one thing was always clear. Those young people's, it was clear from their testimony that they had never learned to think critically. They had never learned to analyze a problem or to think in a way that allowed them to be successful. All those athletes, all these young people have been a part of our educational system. We have simply failed. And it's time that we put those, our adult considerations behind us and start putting children first. And as you know or may know, I have been involved in an effort to amend Minnesota's constitution. Why do that? Because we need a catalyst that will help us actually bring about real change. I noted with interest the series of reports that Dr. Curry pointed out. I suspect if we look at your report, this committee's report, and line them up with those reports, we would see the same thing. Time and time again, we study the problem and don't take action. We need to take action. And that is why I come to the committee to at least share my view that this constitutional amendment can actually bring about change. And I won't go through the language per se. I will note that we can provide that to you. But I would note that what we need is an education system that makes education a right, a civil right, to a quality public education that defines what quality is, that, and I think that's preparing children for their role in our economy, our democracy, and our society. I think we need some kind of measurement tool to ensure that children are learning and that the system is working, and that it's fair. Finally, I think it has to be the highest duty of the state. And I think that it has to be funded. And there has to be some remedy in place when a child's rights are not being fulfilled. We can do that. We can create a system that not only helps children and levels the playing children levels the playing field for children, but also elevates the playing field so that everybody advances. This isn't a case in which if children of color, indigenous children advance, somebody else has to lose. Everybody can gain. And I would encourage the legislature to think seriously, because at the end of the day, given our history, given what has come before and what we haven't done, at the end of the day, we're really presented with two questions. What are we going to do, and when are we going to do it? What are we going to do, and when are we going to do it? If this pandemic and the death of George Floyd doesn't motivate us, I don't know what will. And I say that, let me just say this about George Floyd's death. Many of the students at Justice Page Middle School live in that area. Those children have a right to have an education that allows them to succeed just as much as the other children who go to that school who live in Southwest Minneapolis. We just have to, as adults and as those in charge, decide whether we're going to create that education system. And so thank you again for your work, for the committee's work, and for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Justice Page, for your testimony and also for lifting up the reality that when BIPOC students do better, everyone does better. I think it's an important reminder. And when we think about diversifying our teaching workforce, when we have diverse teachers, all students do better. So we're not talking about a scarcity mindset of who gets more, who gets less. We're talking about lifting all students up. So I appreciate your testimony on that. Up next, I have Nevada Little Wolf.
Thank you, Chair Richardson. Really happy to follow Justice Alan Page. My name is Nevada Little Wolf, and I'm the Executive Director of Our Children Minnesota. So we are the organization and the campaign working to educate, build power for, and pass the Page Amendment. I'm really just excited to be at this hearing today. I'm also just want to thank you, Chair Richardson, for your leadership as the co-chair of on the House Select Committee on Racial Justice and the report that we have to talk about today. I spent a lot of time watching the hearings from last fall and reading the report, and it's just really good work. This committee's work has really been long overdue in Minnesota, and I'm personally very grateful for the leadership here. I'm a citizen of Leech Lake Nation and the state of Minnesota. I am a mother to a 17-year-old daughter with Down syndrome who goes to public school. I also went to public school in Minnesota, and I'm grounded in my Anishinaabe teachings and doing my best to walk a good path and do work every day that sets us up for sets up the next seven generations for a good life. The report states that disparities in academic achievement are not caused by innate differences between the academic ability of students of different races. Rather, a compounding set of circumstances limits the opportunities afforded to children and prevents too many from reaching their full potential. And it's really because of these compounding circumstances that we need systems change. We know that social and economic outcomes are directly linked to students' access and care in our public education systems. Later, the report states there's an intersectional approach, we can see there are also stark disparities for Black, Indigenous, children of color with disabilities. The report's findings are clear about who is negatively impacted and those lasting lifelong effects. Each year that goes by without addressing systemic racism not only costs our state and country billions of dollars, but shuts out our biggest asset, the diversity of our communities. And I really appreciate Dr. Bruce Corey talking about that earlier in his presentation, that we have to really talk about this from an asset-based approach and understanding what that means for the future of Minnesota.
30 seconds.
The report and citizens alike call upon the Minnesota legislature to address this now and to enact laws and policies that address racial disparities and build a more abundant state for all of Minnesota. And the Page Amendment is the transformative policy that creates systems change by flipping the focus from educational systems, which we know are inherently problematic and designed without communities of color and Indigenous people in mind, It flips it to our children's right to quality education and their needs. The Page Amendment is the policy solution. I also want to thank Justice Alan Page, who's the architect of this policy. So, Madam Chair, I am here to partner with you all in solving education gaps, whether it's achievement, disciplinary actions, graduation rates, college readiness, and otherwise. We have support from individuals, businesses, organizations, tribal nations, and a growing list of supporters every day, including bipartisan legislative support. My passion and commitment is to ensuring that we're getting it right today for future generations of our state. So thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this opportunity and I look forward to the work ahead.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Diane Halsey, and on deck, we will have Haley Dickinson.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson. I am Diane Halsey, and I am with Think Small. I am the Senior Vice President of Family Engagement at Think Small, and I'm happy to be here today. At Think Small, I oversee the administration of the Hennepin County and Ramsey County Early Learning Scholarships. At Think Small, we are working to support the full potential for every child, and to that end, Think Small commits to championing policies and practices of equity that empower a just, inclusive, and equitable care and education system for children in their crucial early years. And this will take targeting resources to those that are most in need. I have had the pleasure of administering state early learning scholarships at Think Small for the past 6 years. And in this current fiscal year, almost all of the new families that we are awarding are priority children. And about 78% of those children, of all of those children, are BIPOC children of color, which means that many of these children are also homeless and foster care children. We currently have a wait list of over 1,600 for just Hennepin and Ramsey County. This means that if you are a non-priority applicant, you kind of have a slim chance of being awarded a scholarship. So we are in great need of more funding for this program. Many child care and education policies, like others in the United States, are shaped by a history of systemic racism. And in this case, this manifests itself as a lack of access to high quality, affordable care and education, and the undervaluing of the child care profession. As Dr. Corey so eloquently stated in his presentation, we have one of the largest K-12 education gaps in the nation when comparing white children to children of color. And these achievement gaps began as early as 18 months, often many times much earlier than that, because they are rooted in opportunity gaps. That is the lack of sufficient high quality early childhood experiences. Therefore, to close the achievement gap, Minnesota must close the opportunity gap by prioritizing early childhood investments. Right now, our best investment the state can make is targeting early childhood investments to our most vulnerable children, many of whom are BIPOC children, children of color.
30 seconds.
We'd be able to target investments to these low-income families. However, we must be flexible. Any effort to release the cap on early learning scholarships will allow communities across the state to use the funds as needed, and which would mean in the Twin Cities, fewer children would have to leave in the middle of the year. To close Minnesota's achievement gap, we must close the opportunity gap by ensuring all children can participate in quality early care and education opportunities and start kindergarten ready to succeed. Early learning scholarships are a fundamental policy of an equitable child care and education system. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Haley Dickinson, and then on deck, we have Sitlali Escobar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Haley Dickinson. I am a senior at North St. Paul High School, and I do PSCO at St. Cloud State. I'm not a student of color, so my testimony is really going to be based on my observances, both as a student and as an advocate. There's been a lot of discussion around systemic racism in regard to police violence. That racism is also very present in the education system. As has been stated, there is a very large and widening opportunity gap in Minnesota for a variety of reasons. Disciplinary practices is a big one. Disproportionately, students of color are being suspended as early as elementary school. And the real question there is, what message is that sending? How is pulling students from class really helping them? The reality is it's not. It's not helping to set students up for success and build the set of skills that they will need in life, but rather is focused on discipline and punitive measures that do not help to improve that skill set. So we really need to start shifting from that norm toward practices with restorative and transformative principles. Another big one is mental health. Horrible access to mental health in schools in Minnesota, even worse now with the pandemic. This is important to all students, but especially students of color. I used to be involved in gun violence advocacy, and disproportionately in Black and brown communities, there is a lot of community violence. This has nothing to do with Black people being more violent or anything like that, but it does have partly to do with a lack of resources, including mental health, that aren't available to young people and the rest of the community to stop that cycle of violence. And as someone mentioned, that's just one example of the emotional trauma that continues to worsen. And to that point, there's also a need for a focus on mental health professionals of color. And then there's also the economic justice stance on that, that the report describes really well, of the racial wealth and the racial wage gap, that if students aren't getting this resource in school, it's unlikely or less likely that they'll be able to access it outside of school. Equitable access to after-school programs is another one, ensuring that, you know, regardless of income, students have access to activities that they can participate in after school. This has to do with developmental skills, and it can also just be an outlet. Again, has to do with economic injustice, that this disproportionately impacts not only low-income students, but students of color as well.
30 seconds.
Also, systematically, I think there's something to be said on the fact that we are so based on standardized tests and defining students by a letter grade that should be examined a lot more. Lastly, I just want to emphasize two quick things. First of all, the importance of the intersectional approach to this. You know, the way that students approach their education has a lot to do with outside factors. And, you know, when they walk in the door of their school, in terms of equity, there are a lot of different levels that people walk in on. And so, sure, we can, you know, improve access to resources within school, change our practices in schools, but it's also very dependent on outside factors having to do with justice, environment, or having to do with housing, environmental justice, economic justice, et cetera. And lastly, just to emphasize the importance of youth voice in conversations around education. I've seen a lot more youth testifying on bills around education, and that's great. But bring youth in, you know, if you're in the process of creating bills and throughout, every policy on education directly impacts students, and those voices really need to be included and prioritized in these conversations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate you taking time to come speak with us today. Up next, we have Sitlali Escobar, and on deck, we have Dennis Drawn.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Sitlali Escobar, and I'm a Capital Pathways intern for Ed Allies, a statewide education advocacy nonprofit, and I'm also a senior at Augsburg University, where I'm majoring in political science and sociology. I'm here today to talk to you about what it means to have an education that allows all students in Minnesota to succeed. This is important to me because throughout my K-12 education, I didn't have any teachers of color, which is unacceptable. I'm also here today because I have three younger siblings that are being negatively impacted by these lack of opportunities. Growing up as a Mexican American in Minnesota, my experience in the public school system was at minimum alienating and at most traumatizing. One of the moments that particularly sticks out to me was when I asked my dean to help me apply for college as a senior in high school. As a first generation college student, I didn't know how to apply. But when I met with my dean in her office, she didn't even look at me. Instead, she read my name and said, "Why do you want to go to college? Students like you don't make it, so I think you should be happy where you are now." I know what many of you may be thinking. Wow, there's no way this could have happened recently. Well, I'm here to tell you that this happened in 2016 at the Mountview School District, which is one of the most well-resourced school districts in the state. and this horrifying experience is a common reality for students of color in Minnesota. Even though I did eventually end up succeeding in spite of my dean and the other barriers I overcame, it is frankly unforgivable that the Minnesota school system was ever set up like this for students of color. Following the events of the insurrection at the Capitol in early January, it is clear that Minnesota needs to step up and be willing to lead the country in providing equitable and anti-racist education for all of their students, staff, and community members. One of the ways Minnesota can do this is by investing in the recruitment, training, and retention of teachers of color. This involves not only investing in programs like tuition assistance and loan forgiveness, but also in changing layoff policies to ensure that teachers of color are protected. Secondly, Minnesota must also be willing to take the initiative to mandate anti-racism training and culturally responsive teaching practices. The few teachers and staff of color employed by school districts should not bear the weight of serving as cultural liaisons for the school alone. Instead, Minnesota should mandate these trainings to enhance the skill set of their entire education staff. This ensures that the predominantly white staff will invest in the students of color as much as they do with the white students, and that future administrators won't harm students. Additionally, Minnesota must also increase dual enrollment and rigorous coursework for students of color. Despite my dean, I was still able to take college courses in high school and now be part of the 10% of all Latinas nationally that graduate college. However, what happens to those with deans like mine who refuse to help them? It is essential that all students in Minnesota have access to dual enrollment and rigorous coursework because it is the duty of the state to ensure that all students have all opportunities to succeed. Lastly, I also implore on this committee to add one final strand to the report, ethnic studies. Students are more likely to succeed when they see themselves reflected in the materials. And as Minnesota continues to diversify, its curriculum needs to expand to include narratives from communities of color to ensure the success of all students. Thank you for your time and for your public service.
Thank you so much for your testimony and also for sharing that very personal story with all of us as well. Next up, we have Dennis Drawn, and on deck, we have Shelley Drake.
Members of the legislature and fellow members of the public, my name is Dennis Drawn, and I'm a licensed social studies teacher working in the same district that I grew up in, Osseo Area Schools, where I also serve in a vital role as an equity teacher. With the COVID-19 pandemic still raging in America, it has highlighted the inequities and racial disparities that have always existed in our system. Much can be said about the inequities highlighted in this report, but today I want to focus on two of the recommendations. Through my own experiences, I realized that this education system was not created for Indigenous Black and Brown children. I was never taught about the Black experience or the joys of being a Black man, only our sacrifices. I learned about slavery, which focused on our obedience rather than our accomplishments. This only added to the trauma that I was already facing in my life. The last thing I wanted to see was a man's whipped back, lynchings, and even dogs and fire hoses being sprayed on us while we fought for rights that we are still fighting for today. I never learned about poems of triumph by Langston Hughes, taught that Black doctors exist like Dr. Charles Drew, nor did I learn about Black identity from the words of Angela Davis. This is due to our standards and curriculum always ingrained in whiteness with the focus on teaching to bias standardized tests. Society is quick to blame teachers for these disparities, but I do not blame the educators of my childhood. It's sad to say that I rarely had an educator who was not a Caucasian woman, and frankly, districts in the state have never equipped them to handle a racially diverse student population. Our state needs to recruit, sustain, and retain Black, Brown, and Indigenous educators that mirror our racially diverse student population, who provide various perspectives and help support students in growing their identity. It also provides a positive perspective for white students in suburban and rural communities who never interact with indigenous and people of color. It gives them a chance to experience the brilliance on a daily basis rather than only seeing them in a negative light in the news or even murdered in the hands of police for their lack of obedience. We need to add more counselors and social workers to school support the impact of trauma that is impacting our students. We need to also examine how we can support the mental health of teachers that are trying to navigate the trauma students have and what they have on a day-to-day basis. If we had sufficient counselors, they would have learned that my cousin who stepped in as an older brother because my brother and father were incarcerated was murdered near my home. They would have found out some days the only meals I ate were at school because my mom worked multiple jobs trying to support my younger brother and I. How can anyone expect anything of our Black, Brown, and Indigenous students to learn when they are dealing with trauma in their personal lives and induced fear of the racism that society has normed? We need action now. Schools and students cannot afford to put their trust on empty words and promises We need to see an emphasis on recruiting and retaining educators who mirror our racially diverse population because every student deserves it. I need legislators to think about the kid who is dealing with so much right now with no one to talk to because no counselors or social workers are available to talk. Please remember this, the trauma that these students are dealing with won't just disappear with when the pandemic is over. Educators and students need to need funding and resources now more than ever. Please help us use this opportunity to reshape education for the betterment of all students and rewrite some of the wrongs that have hurt generations. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and also thank you for sharing your very personal story as well. Up next, we have Shelly Drake, and on deck, we have Idil Abdul.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the House Education Policy Committee. I'm here today to testify regarding the importance of fully funding the Increase Teachers of Color Act. My name is Shelly Drake, and I'm a biracial female educator in the Osseo School District, the same district that Dennis works in. I currently serve as the new teacher mentor. In 1990, Dr. Rudine Smith Bishop published an essay about the importance of providing young readers with diverse books that reflect the multicultural nature of the world in which we live, as they serve as mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors. This idea holds true as we need to increase teachers of color. Teachers of color provide mirrors for students of color to see their lives and experiences reflected. Research has shown that teachers of color boost the academic performance of students of color. Black teachers tend to have higher standards of achievement for Black students than white teachers do, resulting in higher test scores, increased graduation rates, and success in college. This is important as we consider the ongoing struggle of eliminating the opportunity gap. My 19-year-old son said that he resonates with teachers of color, drawn to the only one he had as a fifth grader. He knew the Black female educator believed in him unconditionally. Her expectations never wavered as she championed him to be his best. Our students of color need and deserve to be in classrooms of teachers who look like them and who wholly identify with their lived experiences. Teachers of color are windows for all to look through, thus providing multiple perspectives for the entire school community. It is crucial to have our voices and experiences at the center of all conversations to break down stereotypes and interrupt systems of oppression. Currently, students of color make up 35% of Minnesota students, but teachers of color only make up 4% of all teachers. Schools need to be filled with positive role models of all races that represent the community they serve. Teachers of color are sliding glass doors that open to allow students of color to walk through. If we want to draw future educators into the field of education, we need to have people who represent them standing in front of them in the classroom.
30 seconds.
When I asked my 21-year-old son why he thought it was important to increase the number of teachers of color, he said, "Representation matters." His first teacher of color was a Black man who facilitated an affinity group of Black boys when he was in sixth grade. Until then, he thought that it was not an option for Black and brown skinned people to be teachers. Finally, the door to teaching was open for him. Thank you for your support to provide mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors by fully funding the Increase of Teachers of Color Act.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Idil Abdul, and on deck, we will have Tayana Bryant.
All right, thank you so much, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and members. Good afternoon. My name is Idil Abdul, and I am a pissed off Somali autism mom. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify and speak for my son and so many others like him. My son, and I repeat this, the date, the time, and the year that he was suspended every time I testify, because I want it to energize me and I never want to forget that day. He was suspended on Thursday, May 3rd at 5:18 p.m. in 2018 by teacher Kelly Morris and principal Jason Anderson from Jefferson High School in Bloomington Public Schools. My son has nonverbal autism and did not, nor does he now understand what suspension is or comprehends cause-effect. Nevertheless, Kelly and Jason kicked him out from his educational environment. As you are aware and have seen data after data, Minnesota has a horrible and shameful record for racial discipline. This is not an accident. It happens and will continue to happen because there is no accountability for the teachers, nor the principals and the administrators. This is also not an accident, members of the committee. So now what? Now what? As a parent, along with many other families, we cannot keep asking the same question every legislative session. And I've been here since May 3rd of 2018. While nothing happens, nothing meaningful passes, and it's just heartbreaking. For students with special needs, I want to just concentrate on for students with special needs, as you know, are also disproportionately affected by suspensions and expulsions. So I want to suggest some ideas. As I learn and dig what other states are doing, I came across Wisconsin statute, which is attached hopefully to your, it's in your packet somehow, hopefully. Please take a read under the suspension one, particularly question four. And it states the following: may a suspension be appealed? The answer: a parent or a student may within 5 days following the commencement of a suspension have a conference with the school district administrator or his or her designee. The designee might not be the principal, an administrator, or a teacher in the child's school. If the school district administrator or his or her designee finds that the child was suspended unfairly or unjustly, or the suspension was inappropriate given the nature of the offense, or the child suffered under consequences or penalties as a result of the suspension, preference to the suspension must be removed from the child's record. The finding must be made within 15 days of the conference. Imagine if I had such opportunity, along with thousands of other families whose children were kicked out of school unfairly and unjustly. Imagine if the teacher and the administrators were held accountable and had to explain their action and what they did and why they did it. Imagine if children went to school to learn and not be afraid of getting kicked out. Currently, the way Minnesota education laws are written are not child, student, family centered, nor friendly. They are instead teacher, administrator friendly, and protect the adults who chose this profession instead of the kids. My son communicates with device and is routine oriented, as many kids with autism, as you are aware, are. Yet his teacher took away his communication device, disrupted his routine, and then when she didn't understand what he wanted him, she punished him for it for 5 days and kicked him out of school. And she did that because she knew there would be no accountability. There's no transparency. We don't hold the teachers accountable. We don't hold the principals accountable. So I'm going to end with this. It's heartbreaking to hear the stories of the people that testified before me. It's heartbreaking to hear my story. I've been traumatized by this. I can hardly drive by Jefferson High School. Please, members of the committee, think about what other states that are doing better than us, which is almost all of them. What are they doing right? And what can we do to mimic that? I thank you, Madam Chair and members, so much for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony and also being willing to share such a personal story with us today. We appreciate your time and testimony. Up next, we have Tiana Bryant, and on deck, we have Kezia Ojika.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Tiana Bryant. I am a Minnesota native. I'm a mother of six sons as well. Four of which have attended PICA, Head Start, Parents and Community Action, which is one of the largest, it is the largest agency in the state of Minnesota. I have four sons that went through PICA, as I mentioned. Today, I just want to share with you some of the ways that Head Start and its diverse staff have benefited my children and I. I'm in Head Start, my children are taught by teachers of color. 95% of them are teachers of color. Many that look like my children. They understand the challenges that we face every day. I can trust the teachers at Head Start, and they always know what's best for my children. My children's teachers at Head Start, they take the time to get to know them and see what's best for them. As I mentioned, I have six boys, and as many of you know, they have so much energy, can be very active, often learn best by doing. Head Start teachers understand that, and they take into account each child's unique learning style. My children are really engaged in learning and can't wait to go back to Head Start. They've been distant learning, of course, but they can't wait to get back. On the other hand, I have a 19-year-old who recently graduated from the public schools here. It was definitely a struggle going through school with him and not seeing a lot of teachers that looked like him or didn't understand where he came from or the things that he went through. He had his times of being suspended for things that I did not think and I know that weren't right. They don't always get the respect that they deserve as individuals, and they don't always tune in the way that I've seen the Head Start teachers tune in with them. I know that they have a lot on their plate, I get it, but it helps a lot when they look like and speak like the same language and can really relate to their students. As I mentioned, at Head Start, at PICA, I had a lot of opportunities to be involved and to know the importance of my children's education. As I mentioned, I'm a Minnesota native. I didn't have teachers of color, many teachers. I think I had one coming up in elementary school, and I have to admit, it made me feel inferior because I didn't see the importance of who I am with my color. And as the man mentioned before, just showing the videos of the slaves lynching and things of that nature, I didn't see my importance of me being who I am. I believe that more teachers put in the positions that can teach our children would help out so much. I have a son, as I mentioned, who's 19. He lost two of his friends back to back during the summer. I live North Minneapolis. The crime rate has went sky high. And I know that if they had teachers of colors, if they had someone who can understand them, who can help them to know the importance of education, that they wouldn't be in these streets taking each other's lives. They will see the value of having an education to know that there's so much more here that they can get out of the things that the environment around here shows them, the statistics that they're put under.
30 seconds.
Head Start has taught me so much in being involved with my children's education, as I mentioned before, and to interact with my children at home to support what they're learning in the school, especially during a distant learning time. It has really helped me out. I know that I can feel welcome during my time at Head Start. It felt like family. I'm now the policy council. I'm this year in policy council. So I'm excited about that. I'm learning new things every day. And I know that families of all races, ethnicities, and cultural backgrounds are welcome too. I don't have enough time here to tell you all of the things that Head Start's done for my family and why that I see that it's important to have teachers of color teaching my children and other children that look like ours. But I know that we've learned that together we can go so far. There's so much, so many opportunities that our children have, so talented, but they don't receive that and they don't know that when they're not often reminded it by seeing people that look like them, where they know that they can make it to the next level. So I thank you all for hearing my testimony and for having me here today. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your testimony and your story as well. We appreciate you taking the time today. Up next, we have Kezia Ojika and on deck, Leslie Jackson.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Kezia Ojika, and I am the program manager of the Connects program at Girl Scouts of Minnesota and River Valleys. I would like to thank the House Select Committee on Racial Justice and this committee for focusing on this important work. The Girl Scouts strongly supports these racial justice recommendations, especially in the education section, and the Connects program is a successful example of these recommendations. In its 10th year, Connects has adapted to each girl and community, providing social and emotional skill development, leadership opportunities, and supplemental STEM education in a culturally responsive way to underserved and under-resourced girls. The holistic program is provided at no cost to girls and families. Last year, Connects served nearly 3,000 girls across the metro area and southern third of the state, primarily girls of color. 90% qualify for free or reduced price lunch. Our Connects troops are staff led by youth development professionals, and a majority of us identify as women of color. For those who are wondering how the racial justice recommendations could look in practice, here are some examples using the Connects program. Our organization has worked in collaboration with schools and districts. When Rochester Public Schools was establishing their full-service community schools, it partnered with Girl Scouts River Valleys to determine nonprofit services tailored to the needs of girls of color from low-income communities. The Connects program challenges girls to be engaged in their community and build lifelong skills through civics and advocacy opportunities, as well as essential financial literacy and money management. Me and the rest of our program leaders are women of color. We have training in youth development and are dedicated to the success of girls of color. Connects girls learn about different career paths and what success after high school can look like. By hosting programs in partnership with Dunwoody College and Century College, the Connects girls meet and learn about women in trade and STEM professions, as well as available coursework. We provide guidance and assistance as girls apply to college and seek financial aid, often sharing our own experience navigating these systems. The outcomes of this program are proof that these recommendations can work. 2 in 3 of Connects girls will be the first generation college students. 73% of the Connects girls are more confident as they have stronger social emotional skill sets. In the St. Paul Public Schools, where 93% of program participants are girls of color, 91% graduate high school on time, and 7 in 10 girls utilize Connects exclusively. That means this is the only leadership and college and career readiness program these girls are exposed to. So, Madam Chair, the Connects program is an example that these racial justice recommendations can and do work. When the time comes to implement these education policy recommendations, the Girl Scouts encourages you to consider programs like these for partnership and investment. Thank you for your opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Leslie Jackson, and on deck, we have Dr. Kathleen Campbell.
Thank you for having me today. My story is no different than those before me, but I experienced racism. Born and raised in Minneapolis, I attended several Minneapolis public schools. I was one of the first in my group of students that graduated from North High in the class of 75 to be a transplant for desegregation in the Minneapolis school program. I was attending John Hay and was placed in Nokomis Junior High, where I had my first racial experience with a professor who ripped my shirt up, telling me my seams were wrong, scolding me in front of the classroom, alienating me. At the time, I didn't know about racism because I grew up with people in my family who graduated and were studying at the University of Minnesota. And words that were called nigger and that was not allowed because we weren't, because anything you want to read, you put it in a book. So we spent time reading, and books were a Christmas gift in my family. As I said, I experienced racism to the point where the Board of Regents had to get involved for me to graduate. I didn't know if it was the professor, the staff, or the students. I worked security. I worked recycling. I sat in classrooms where I was questioned why I even was there on a full scholarship. Mind you, I am an older woman, 63 as the age right now, on a full scholarship, disabled with a traumatic brain injury, that obtained a scholarship with the BS Environmental Science Policy and Management, where I was ostracized by classmates, made fun of by professors, reported every incident to the EOAA. Once I finished there, I got enrolled after school program at Jenny Lind, North Minneapolis, where I had created my interest in working back in my community as my family members have done, being the first county Black attorney, godfather, first criminal judge posting. So education was instilled in me. But working there as an after-school aide and wanting to place air monitors and rain gauges because I was fascinated about it, working at the public pollution control, it gained an interest with HERC being over North Minneapolis. So I left there being screamed at by a assistant principal, a white lady, that I wasn't wanted there, nor anything I had to offer. So with the pollution control, the National Weather Bureau, that project of mine had got shut down at Jenny Lind, where they have a high level of asthmatic children. I also witnessed the behavior of those white teachers, and I have to say it because that's what I've seen, and the black ones who ignored what was going on. I witnessed that same assistant principal have a child blocked in an elevator with another person I don't know, had a child walking back and forth like a caged animal. Overhearing some of the conversation, if you don't listen to me, I will call the police on you. I was stunned and thrown back, taking the class to the assigned classroom. I also experienced getting hit hard off my feet while walking by a social worker, the same social worker with my after-school supervisor, laughing at children calling each other nigger. I witnessed a child beat another kid, and when I stopped it, I asked why. He said, oh my God, the words that came out that young man's mouth was unastonished to me. Reporting it to that same supervisor, she told me she's protecting the child from me because I wanted the phone number to report the child's behavior to the parent. And what about the child that got abused? She hurried the child off. Next thing I know, I'm ostracized. I got certified for the Lung Association to try to make the difference because of the high asthmatic. They're taught to collaborate with the nurse as well as the liaison who used to be a security there for the family. And both of them reported me and said, my plan was good, but I'm in their way. I don't know. All I wanted to do is use my degree in science to bring to my community, to educate my community about the pollutants and the toxins. And everyone talks about the black teachers. Well, being at the University of Minnesota and dealing with all the racism and the hidden racism there, when you report it, which needs to be investigated, as well as those professors and the limited amount of black students from Minnesota, and you really want to get to the roots of it. I didn't know what was going on there. But you want black teachers, Minnesota's not producing them because of the racism that we endure in the school. All I'm saying is we need to change. We need to investigate. I love Minnesota. The education I have is totally changed from those that my great-grandchildren are getting now. Thank God they're not in Minneapolis public schools, but they're getting a good shake in the suburbs where everybody moved from. So not just the black community, we are mixed and diverse in the state of Minnesota and in the city. So when the black kids suffer, so do the white kids. So where does the line cross? We need to invest these people that we have in office and these places that are teaching our children and those that are running the black teachers away that want to teach the kids. Those are the people that we need to stop, the fastest in the education system. And I will advocate and I will write my story all the way fully out in detail and submit it to this committee. I thank you for your time. And also, since I graduated, I sit on 4 different environmental justice committees within the city of Minneapolis, helping the injustice that we endure as a community in the city. You do one injustice us all, and it's been known for a fact. It's not about color. It's Jackson, keeping only the strong survive. Thank you.
Sorry to have to cut you
off.
Thank you. We had several testifiers ago. Thank you so much for coming today and sharing your story and being willing to put more in writing for the committee. We appreciate that. Dr. Kathleen Campbell, and up on deck, we have Dr. Julie Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and members of the House Education Policy Committee. My name is Dr. Kathleen Campbell, and I'm the Dean of the School of Education at the University of St. Thomas. I'm here today to speak in support of the recommendations that were outlined for the education sector in the House Select Committee on Racial Justice report. Speaking as a dean who oversees teacher and administrator preparation programs, as well as a former public school kindergarten teacher, I think it's imperative for us to take action in order to address the challenges that are facing us in education. Specifically, there are four findings that I'd like to highlight from the report. First, I echo the sentiment that we need to increase our investment in recruiting, training, retaining, and promoting BIPOC teachers. At St. Thomas, we're able to reduce the number of credits required of teachers in training by utilizing our non-conventional Grow Your Own pathways. We partner with school districts in order to offer degrees in shortage areas like special education. And research shows that not only do BIPOC teachers help to close the academic or opportunity gaps for students of color, but they also benefit all children because they now are able to see racially diverse teachers. Second, we strongly advocate implementing stipends for mentor teachers and paid student teaching opportunities. While we have managed to secure some funds for scholarships to support our students to become teachers, the need is far greater than the funding support that we're currently able to provide at this moment. Third, the School of Education fully supports mandating training for teachers, both current and those who are becoming teachers, paraprofessionals, and administrators in anti-racist, culturally responsive, trauma-informed, and restorative practices. We believe professional development must provide an understanding of the systemic nature of racialized and intersectional inequalities and how education can disrupt them through humanizing relationships and asset-based approaches. And you had a chance to hear that in some presentations earlier today. And then lastly, we recognize that there is a need to develop an emergency funding program for post-secondary students. As we're all aware, many of our post-secondary students were struggling to make ends meet prior to the pandemic. Now it's become even more difficult for them to pay for their basic necessities while also attending school. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for this hearing to discuss the Racial Justice Report and its findings. And as a dean of a school of education, I personally felt it was imperative to advocate for supports that are needed in the education sector to positively impact children.
Thank you for your testimony. So we currently still have three testifiers to go, and we have four members with hands up. And so I'm going to ask the remaining testifiers if you could keep your remarks to 2 minutes, and you may also submit written testimony as well if there are things that you do not get to. Dr. Julie Bunn.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity and also for the opportunity to have heard from my fellow Minnesotans in the powerful and personal testimony today. I'm Dr. Julie Bunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, organization that for 60 years has been devoted to increasing financial and economic literacy education in Minnesota, primarily through the teaching of teachers to deliver economics and financial literacy education in Minnesota public and private schools over that time period. I'm here today to support the recommendation of the committee, select committee, to increase and require financial literacy education, not only for all Minnesotans, but in particular for students of color, BIPOC students in Minnesota. Minnesota strongly believes that all Minnesotans need access to this education, but in particular, if it's not delivered equitably and equally across the state and available to all students at a level of quality, that in fact, it would lead to a widening of the opportunity and education gap rather than narrowing it over time. So we must have that equity into the delivery of financial literacy education. In 2013, standards within social studies for economics and finance in Minnesota were implemented. Those are undergoing review and revision this year. Within those were standards for financial literacy for personal finance are embedded. At the high school level, those benchmarks require about 9 to 10 hours of personal finance education in our high schools.
30 seconds.
Nationally, we know that financial literacy education is poor financial knowledge in the Minnesota. We also know that there's tremendous racial and gender gaps with financial literacy. We also know that I'm doing bullets now for your time. We also know that even 10 hours of financial literacy education at the high school level leads to tremendous behavioral changes among students in the near term and over the longer run. These gaps can be addressed by higher quality education, equitable access to that education, and most importantly, as referenced here, culturally responsive and anti-racist delivery of education and personal finance. The Minnesota Council has been developing lessons in pedagogy and cultural responsive education in personal finance for the last 4 years, our annual conference entirely on the subject. I commend you for including this recommendation about financial literacy, education, and personal finance in your report and fully support it and work to collaborate with all of you and others to implement it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Barb Fabre and Bill Kelty is on deck. Okay, not hearing from Barb, we'll move on to Bill Kelty.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are, okay.
Sorry, my name is Barb Faber, and thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak on this important committee. I'm a tribal member and a former administrator for Minnesota's Race to the Top grant and later the state's Early Learning Scholarship Program. First of all, I want to echo what Diane Halsey presented. As members of the BIPOC communities, we understand the impact of early learning scholarships to our communities, to our parents, but mostly the impact on children. Scholarships are flexible for parents and caregivers. They meet parents and the caregivers' needs. The scholarships follow the child anywhere in Minnesota, which is unheard of. Scholarships mean quality care for BIPOC children. We all know that there are huge gaps here in Minnesota, especially for BIPOC children. We have the lowest graduation rates, but we have the highest dropout rates, we have the highest out-of-home placements, and we also have the highest number of suicide rates, as well as poverty rates. These numbers are not what Minnesota should have. We need to invest in our early learning opportunities for BIPOC children. We need to look at those numbers and put our efforts where it counts, early childhood. When we invest in early learning scholarships, we are investing in children by putting them into high quality early childhood settings that have a high impact on laying a strong foundation of learning, and it promotes parent engagement. So there are gaps right now in early childhood and for our Indigenous children. And in my experience, the most promising program has been with early learning scholarship program. So, we have the data. Learning starts at birth, and years of brain research has given us the roadmap to make a difference in a child's life. We need to look at that. We need
time.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
No, thank you for your testimony. And also, if you have more to say, please feel free to submit that in writing. Next up, we have Bill Kelty, and on deck we have Helen Bassett. Not hearing from Bill, Helen Bassett.
Hello, Madam Chair, and thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for having this hearing and certainly for my opportunity to speak today. My comments, and I did submit a presentation, and I do have it. And with your permission, Chair, I will show that, and hopefully it will come up. You know, I'm always
please proceed with this.
Okay, and so of course, you know, I've already shared my thanks and for being here, and a little bit of background about myself here too. I am currently a school board member at Robbinsdale, but here today to really talk about now, if I can just advance this thing. And I did submit it, so I think I don't want to get bogged down here. So I think what I'm going to do is just go ahead and speak because you have limited time. But so my first comments, and of course I want to also pay homage to the work that the Select Committee did on racial justice in the final report. And my comments are drawn from this today and to a large extent, and also House File 217. I'm speaking specifically in support of increased diversity in the ranks of Minnesota school teachers for Indigenous and people of color, and then also to create pathways to create and maintain opportunities that support the development of shared cultural understanding among teachers, students, and leaders, setting policy. So in our own school district in Robbinsdale, we have actually adopted for our legislative platform this year, enhanced educator workforce. And I guess I want to just, maybe I'll go quickly then over to the statements that was made by the 2019 Teacher of the Year. We need to ensure that our board members reflect the populations of the districts we serve in their entirety. Plainly put, representation matters. It matters in the classroom. It matters at the board table. The Minnesota Public Radio has several times alluded to the importance of having leadership that reflects the communities that we serve in public education. I can't speak strongly enough about that. Our board recently adopted an equity policy. We're now trying to work toward infusing our equity policy into the policies and practices that we have in our district. That does not happen overnight, and it requires strong leadership and committed leadership. And so, well, thank you very much, committee, for this important meeting today, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ms. Bassett, for sharing the information and also for including that within packets as well. It looks like we now have Bill Kelty.
You do. Can you hear me?
Yes, please proceed.
Oh, good. I apologize for that. Thank you for this opportunity. I represent a group of diverse educators, school members, parents, teachers, business entrepreneurs, and students who have formed a nonprofit and have a website that contains all of the research and rationale that supports our legislative initiative. Last term, prior to the pandemic, we had secured 46 signatures, bipartisan support, on language calling for a systemic change in public education in Minnesota. During that session, Representative, you are one of those who signed on our legislation. Last October, I spoke for the allotted 3 minutes at the hearing on the House Select Committee on Racial Justice. I was preceded by a number of agencies and individuals calling for a systemic change in education, and I was able to offer a solution pointing to our website. Since December, we have been hosting Zoom meetings with legislators and have commitments from these legislators to sign on our newer version of the legislation. Our nonprofit, Innovate Instruction, Ignite Learning, is seeking support for legislation that impacts all students, including the gifted. We are proposing that the focus of teaching and learning in our schools, K through 12, be on thinking. Districts would be expected to teach the advanced thinking skills of this legislation. Critical thinking, creative thinking, inquiry learning, problem-based learning, and how to work collaboratively all would be taught to all students K through 12. If taught with fidelity, this research supporting these advanced skills provide ample evidence, positive evidence, impacting student achievement. More students of color and disabled students would be identified for gifted programming. All students would be engaged in learning and motivated to learn and be better prepared for advanced coursework in high school, trade school, and in college. The research we have is on the website in this argument. Please have your LA contact us, and I'll reschedule the meeting we had earlier this season and let you know more about this and provide you with the evidence about student engagement and motivation to learn. And thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Being that we only have 2 minutes left, I want to remind members that we are not meeting on Wednesday, but you can tentatively plan on Friday hearings on March 5th and March 12th from 1 p.m. to 3 o'clock p.m. We will start first with questions from Representative Scott, and if you could be as brief as possible, because we want to get to as many as possible.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had just a brief question for Dr. Corey and one brief question for Justice Page, and I'll just shoot those out right now. Dr. Corey, you said that the bar is set very low in Minnesota compared to other countries such as Singapore. And my question to you is, can we raise the bar by just meeting state standards? That's my question for Dr. Corey.
And Representative Scott, we're just going to go with that one question because we're at 2:29 and we have to end at 2:30. Dr. Corey.
Briefly, yes, we can raise the bar and improve the quality of education. But I'd be happy to talk with you later.
So do the current state standards, do they raise the bar enough?
Because I am not, Chair Richardson, Representative Scott. I am not intimately familiar with existing standards. I'm familiar with the outcomes, and the outcomes definitely show that we need to move up.
Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, so we have to go, I just want to say that, again, I appreciate the fact that we're providing this forum for all of these testifiers to come and these subject matter experts to come and share their information. And again, I just encourage my colleagues in the House, any of my colleagues over in the Senate, if you're listening to this, this is what we need to do. Please take heed as we're making policy and passing legislation.
Thank you, Representative Frazier, Representative Erdahl, and Representative Hassan. Sorry that we are going to have to close out the committee right now, but I'm sure all testifiers would be happy to connect with you. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.